calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to our program, my friends. Greetings, friends, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, 6 minutes past the hour. Andy Bernstein is with us with the Ayn Rand Organization, AYNRAND.org. Andy is also he's a senior writer with Ayn Rand. He's also the author of The Capitalist Manifesto, the historic economic and philosophic case for laissez-faire, laissez-faire being French for more or less for no rules, no controls. Just let capitalism do what capitalism does best. And Andy, I've suggested many times that the Roosevelt administration saved capitalism from itself, that we had several other nations in the world at that time, at that point in history, that were flipping from capitalism to communism as a result of the failures of laissez-faire capitalism. And, that it was a good thing for America that Roosevelt saved capitalism from itself. Here we have another example of it. We have high-tech firms like Yahoo and Google are helping China censor words like freedom and democracy, and this is the free market.
Well, Tom, first of all, I don't agree that FDR saved capitalism. I think he moved us into deeper into statism with socialist policies and continued the depression for many years more than it needed to. But the disturbing thing in China, of course, is that some of these companies like Microsoft, Yahoo, Google are helping the communist censors suppress terms on the internet like freedom. I think we should applaud the companies who are refusing to kowtow to the Chinese censors, like the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, USA Today. But I think it's shame on Microsoft and these other companies for violating the principle of individual rights that freedom and capitalism depend on.
Well, which brings us to the fundamental problem here. You have a news release over at Ayn Rand Institute, a press release at ayn rand.org, that talks about this, and it wraps up by saying U.S. companies should not do business in China if the price is to help destroy the very rights and freedoms that make their own economic success possible. I agree with the sentiment, but, basically you're whining about the company's behavior.
Well, in fairness to these companies, I think we should point out that even when capitalists or successful businessmen, even when they oppose the principle of individual rights, that forms the basis of capitalism, it's still true that they've been enormously productive and we're all wealthy because of them. So I don't want to overlook their achievements, but still, capitalism depends on freedom. It's a system of individual rights. They are their own profit depends upon their right to own property, to make money, to keep their money.
Capitalism isn't a system of individual rights. Democracy in a constitutionally limited democratic republic is a system of individual rights. Capitalism is making money with money. Well, you're confusing economics and politics here.
Well, we've had this discussion many times, Tom. I think there's no such thing as an economic system without a political system, and the principle of individual rights is the political basis for capitalism.
You have capitalism existing right now in China, which is a communist dictatorship.
Right, it is a communist dictatorship, and I think America.
And yet capitalism is flourishing there. So I agree with you that you can't have capitalism without a political system, but frankly, it appears that the political system doesn't have to in any way respect individual rights other than the right of somebody with a lot of money to be able to build a business and hire people who don't have a lot of money and are willing to work for whatever that person's willing to pay them.
Well, their foundation is in the freer country, such as America, where the principle of individual rights to some degree is respected.
China's GDP is growing at twice ours right now.
No, but if the whole world were like China, if the whole world were a communist system, there would be no such companies as Microsoft or Google. They rely on their rights are morally and legally protected to a great degree in America. That's their base of operations. They need the principle of individual rights. They should stop slitting their own throats. Is the point here? They should lobby incessantly around the world for the same principle of individual rights that the United States was founded on, that makes their own existence and their own profit possible.
But to use Asia as the example here, we're speaking with Dr. Andrew Bernstein. He's the author of The Capitalist Manifesto and a senior writer at the Ayn Rand Institute. To use Eastern Asia or Asia as the example, I think, really highlights the point that I've been making in our conversations low these many years here, Andy Bernstein, which is that capitalism does not require freedom or democracy. It only requires a certain level of economic freedom. And, for example, I've gave a speech in Singapore a couple of years ago, and it was about education. I was talking to a group of educators, and the question came up, you know, how do you go about solving the problems of reforming the school system? And I gave the answer that I have given when I've given this talk. I've written 7 books on this, on topics of education and whatnot. And I said, the same talk I've given in England and in Germany and in France and in countries in Africa and Australia. And so in Singapore, which is a capitalist paradise, and I think you have to acknowledge knowledge has been for, 30 years or so, a place where, by the way, if you put gum on the sidewalk, you will be arrested and thrown in jail for a month. So anyhow, my answer to the group was, you have to get politically active. You have to get out there and talk to your elected officials, because I thought, dumb me, that I was, since this was a capitalist state, that it also was a democratic state. I said, you have to get politically active. And it was as if I had farted. I mean, the entire room, loudly, the entire room just went silent and was shocked. And there was no follow-up question. I mean, that was the end of it. And then afterwards, one of the people from the conference said, you never should talk about politics here. And then, we went out, we had lunch, and 2 hours later, I made it back to the hotel that I was staying at, 5-star hotel in Singapore, downtown Singapore. Somebody had gone through my hotel room, pulled all the drawers out, flipped the contents upside down, torn apart the bed. I mean, they had stripped that room, taken my suitcase, all my clothes were on the floor, and it was their way of saying, we know you're here, and how dare you talk about politics in our country. It was, it was clearly the state police who had done it. The hotel, I reported at the hotel, and they were like, I mean, there is no relationship between an economic system and a political system beyond the need for capitalism to have at least, courts that allow it to function and a decent currency.
Well, see, I don't agree. I think Singapore, for instance, like many countries around the world, including the United States, is basically a mixed economy or a mixed system. There's some elements of individual rights and some elements of abrogating those rights. And Singapore, to some degree, is a dictatorship with, as you pointed out, where the dictators allow a significant elements of the free market in their economics. But still, my point here is that the businessmen, whether it's Bill Gates at Microsoft or anybody else, need to recognize that their ability to own property, to make profit, to keep their money, depends upon the principle of individual rights, which is the same principle that gives rise to freedom of speech. And they need to defend individual rights across the board in the economic realm as well as in the moral realm.
But lacking a strong body politic that is engaged by we the people, whether it's here in the United States or in China. People who believe that laissez-faire, like yourself, who believe that laissez-faire capitalism is the cure for everything, are reduced in the face of things like capitalism running amok in China and censoring the word democracy and the word freedom and the phrase Tiananmen massacre from search engines, are reduced to simply whining to the companies and asking them to behave decently. Don't you agree that there needs to be the force of government to be able to say to corporations, hey, you want to make money? Fine, we like that, but you're going to have to play by a certain set of rules.
Well, I absolutely agree with that. Laissez-faire capitalism does not mean anarchy, does not mean an absence of government. It means limited government.
It means unrestrained capitalism.
Individual rights. And Tom, the problem in China with censorship is fundamentally that you have a communist totalitarian regime that unfortunately some of these companies are kissing up to. Under true capitalism, when you would not have totalitarian government, you couldn't censor people from using words like freedom, individual rights, Tiananmen Square massacre.
Why not? There is no constitution for capitalism, Andrew.
But
unless it's your book, The Capitalist Manifesto.
No, the U.S. Constitution would do just fine with the Bill of Rights if it was enforced.
But the U.S. Constitution is not a capitalist document. It is a democratic republican document.
Well, it's a republican document. But the key point is the principle of individual rights, and that's what capitalism rests on. Businessmen need the right to make money and own property, just as all of us need the right of freedom of speech.
Then why are they making more money in China than they are in the U.S. right now?
I don't know that they're making more money in China.
I mean, they're growing fast.
Microsoft did pretty well in the United States. I'm not sure that's accurate, but it's not really the main point. The main point is if the world were like the Chinese communist regime, they would be in incessant daily danger of being nationalized. We've seen it over and over again. Under a totalitarian state, they have no right to their property. They exist only at the privilege of the government. It's being based in America with some degree of individual rights, that their property is protected. That's why they could flourish. If the whole world were like the Chinese regime, they would have no chance. They would be nationalized and they would be out of business.
And yet, Andrew, those states that have the most mixed economies, for example, the Scandinavian states, have the highest standard of living, the longest lifespan, the happiest people.
Oh, Tom, Sweden, for instance, and the other Scandinavian mixed economies, their productivity levels are declining and have been for years. Their standard of living is going down, and I don't think their standard of living is as high.
That's because increasingly they're embracing neoliberalism, laissez-faire capitalism.
Well, that will raise their standard of living. Sweden
but they're going down. Anyhow, we got to wrap it up here. We'll continue this next time. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. I want to be just like my presidents. I want to make more money than I can spend. I want to build more bombs than I can send. Somewhere I can even spell the name of.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Just reading this speech by George W. Bush to the veterans of foreign wars. He says, in a free society, there's only one check on political speech, and that's the judgment of the American people. So I ask all Americans to hold their elected leaders to account and demand a debate that brings credit to our democracy, not comfort to our adversaries. Do you get this? The President of the United States is asking Americans to contact their politicians and ask them not to oppose the President of the United States. This is outrageous. This is absolutely outrageous. Representative Adam Schiff, who met with Mr. Bush recently at the White House and praised the President's recent efforts. This, by the way, from the Globe and Mail in Toronto. To gather differing viewpoints and welcome the call for a more civil dialogue. But Mr. Schiff said the process must begin at the White House, which he said has brought the debate down a significant notch when it attacked John Murtha, a respected veteran and longtime hawk. Some of the worst culprits, said Mr. Schiff, in worsening the dialogue in Iraq have come from the White House. It's got to be a two-way street. Bush is out there just, you know, banging away at this stuff, and he is increasingly starting to sound like Joe Stalin. I mean, this is, I'm just amazed. Anyhow, welcome back to our program. The Alito hearings are ongoing, or going on, as they say, continuing at this moment, I believe at this moment as we speak. They certainly started a little while ago. We will be hearing in the second hour of our program from Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service, with our daily report from Washington, D.C. about, you know, what's happening there and with all of that. We're also going to have Jeff Feldman on in our second hour of our program. He's the editor-in-chief of Frameshop. Frameshopisopen.com, the website. Probably one of the premier people in the United States who is adept at analyzing the neurolinguistic programming framing techniques being used by the Bush administration and Republicans in general to cause Americans to think that up is down, left is right, red is green, whatever, fill in the blank. And we're going to hear about the latest frame that the Bush administration has trotted out, how they are trying to use it, where you can find it. And then in the third hour of our program, we have a Green Watch alert, and we'll continue with your phone calls. Our telephone number, by the way, 866-440-8466, toll-free all across the United States. And if you want to drop into our live chat room, you're welcome to come in and say hi. Easy way to get there, go to tomhartman.com and just simply click the live chat link. Our discussion with Andrew Bernstein in the last segment, the first segment of the program. I just want to keep these dialogues going. It is so important in my mind for Americans, and for particularly progressive Americans, to understand the philosophical underpinning of the right. You know, I realize that the strategy that the right uses, for example, you know, you listen to Limbaugh, you listen to Hannity, you listen to these guys, and they basically say, oh, liberals are all terrible, they hate America, they're evil people, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, their strategy is to simply villainize patriotic Americans who simply disagree with them on issues. I think, you know, over the short term, it's a strategy that has had some success, but I think over the long term, it's a strategy that's going to fail miserably. Because you don't end up with a more informed electorate. You just end up with angry and frightened people. And on this program, I really want to do what I think is the vital thing, helping people win the water cooler wars, giving you the opportunity to actually understand the other side's point of view so you can argue it. And so when things are being debated before Congress, whether it's the bankruptcy bill or CAFTA or whatever it may be, you actually understand the issues. And I know many of you do. But having these kind of debates on a regular basis really helps highlight and sharpen these issues. And I think it's so, I just think it's so important. And I get a lot of feedback from you who are listening who agree and who want to hear it. And so, we'll continue with that. Yesterday, Sam Alito, Senator Schumer tried to pin him down. And this was an absolutely brilliant thing that I want to get to and just kind of lay out for you right after the break here at the bottom of the hour and play a bit of an extended clip with commentary of Sam Alito on, you know, what he had to say about that. And also, you know, he's become the master of dodging things. Russ Feingold yesterday nearly got him. He started out saying, you know, you were in these sessions with the White House where you were being rehearsed and all this kind of thing, and I'd like to know who was there with you. And then Alito starts to answer, and Feingold interrupts him, and I think Arlen Specter wanted to know, you know, who was it? You know, because he says, you know, let him answer the question. He never got around to answering the question, who was there. And, of course, where that would have been going was Lindsey Graham, and maybe that's why none of the senators wanted to make a big stink out of it, because Lindsey Graham's right there on the panel, and apparently he has committed a serious violation of at least Senate rules and ethics, probably not a legal violation, but certainly a breach of protocol, by rehearsing with Alito the kinds of responses he should be giving to the kinds of questions he's being asked. And so anyhow, that started out. But this interchange with Schumer, and I want to tell you about the history of abortion in the United States and how this is being taken down and why. It's 27 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Boy, it's amazing how this thing is being spun. It's the Democrats are throwing softballs. The Republicans are sucking up to him. MSNBC yesterday, this from Media Matters for America, from noon to 4 p.m. Eastern time, 3 to 7 p.m. Pacific time, the network featured interviews with MSNBC political analyst and former Republican presidential candidate Pat Buchanan, former Republican National Committee Chairman Ed Gillespie, who, by the way, served as the White House's advisor for the Alito process, and Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist. Did they have a Democrat on talking about Alito? No, not one. Did they have a progressive commentator on talking about Alito? No, not one. In addition to Gillespie, Buchanan, and Frist, they featured Chief White House correspondent Nora O'Donnell, who, by virtue of her job description, has to suck up to the White House. She interviewed Buchanan three times. MSNBC live anchor Chris Jansing, who interviewed Buchanan once. And NBC News Chief Justice correspondent Pete Williams. Pete Williams, by the way, is the guy who falsely suggested that Alito had followed a precedent that had been set by Sandra Day O'Connor when he voted to say that women had to get their husband's permission, had to notify their husbands before they got an abortion. I mean, that's the kind of coverage we're getting on this thing. And then we look at, you know, what was actually said, what was being said. You know, for example, I mean, the fact that he absolutely refused to be pinned down on this. This is something. This should be huge news. I mean, the headlines in the newspapers today, everything that I'm seeing anyway, is all like, you know, Alito's having a good time. He's skating through. He hasn't been hit with a... No, it's all softballs. No. Chuck Schumer tried to get him to answer just a straight-up question. Back in 1985, Sam Alito wrote that he proudly, he put the word proudly in, that he proudly personally believed that there was no right to an abortion in the Constitution. Of course, the word abortion doesn't appear in the Constitution. In fact, abortions weren't, they began becoming illegal. At the time the Constitution was written, abortion was not against the law. In fact, by the time anti-abortion laws first began to appear in the United States, the first one was in Connecticut in 1821, and that was after quickening. In other words, you could have an abortion up until the time when you could feel the baby move. Prior to that, it was legal. And that was in 1821. That was the first anti-abortion laws in Connecticut. New York the next year did the same thing. 8 years later did the same thing. But most of those laws were actually concerned. The reason they put those laws into place was that women were dying because of the bad sanitary conditions around these later abortions. And so the safety of the procedure was what they were concerned about. So, but in any case, at the founding of this country, abortion was not illegal. Is there a right to abortion in the Constitution? The word abortion, no, it doesn't appear there. Is there a right to chew your food in the Constitution? No, sorry, that doesn't appear there. Is there a right to get married in the Constitution? No, that's not there either. I mean, if you want to get really technical about this. So here is Schumer asking Alito, sir, you said in 85 that you're proud to say that there's no right to an abortion in the Constitution, and in other places you argued that, we should be basically taking this thing out, take out Roe v. Wade. What do you say now? And Alito, of course, weaseling around on this thing. Here he is.
Regardless of case law, in 1985, you stated it proudly, unequivocally, without exception, that the Constitution does not protect a right to an abortion. Do you believe that now?
It's the $64,000 question. He's going to weasel. Just listen to the ways that this guy tries to weasel out of this question. Do you believe now what you said in 1985, that you were proud to believe that the Constitution doesn't protect the right to an abortion?
I'm not asking about case law. I'm not asking about stare decisis. I'm asking your view about this document and whether what you stated in 1985 you believe today, you changed your view, you distanced your view. If you can give me a direct answer, it doesn't matter right now which way you answer, but I think it's important that you answer that question.
Okay, Alito.
Answer to the question is that I would address that issue in accordance with the judicial process as as I have practiced it.
Don't let him get away with it, Charles.
I can answer that question.
Sir, I'm not asking for the process. Obviously, you use a judicial mind frame. You've been a judge for 15 years. I'm asking you, you stated what you believe the Constitution contained. You didn't say the Constitution as interpreted by this or that. You didn't say the Constitution with this exception or that exception. It was a statement you made directly. You made it proudly. You said you're particularly proud of that personal belief that you had. You still believe it.
Yeah, it's just the simplest, straightforward question. He could have simply said, yes, I still believe it, or no, I don't. But the White House has coached him well.
And, Senator, I would make up my mind on that question if I got to it, if I got past the issue of stare decisis.
Now, I got to tell you, stare decisis means it's already been decided. In other words, the Supreme Court has ruled on something before. But, see, stare decisis gets blown away all the time. For example, in 1896, in Plessy versus Ferguson, the court ruled that blacks and whites should be segregated. And, for 58 years, that was stare decisis. But it got overruled in 1954 with Brown versus Board of Education. In 1873, in Bradwell versus State, the court ruled that women have no identity, legal identity separate from their husbands. That got overruled with Roe v. Wade in 1973. So stare decisis can be thrown out the window, and often is. But in any case, he continues.
After going through the whole process that I've described, I would need to know the case that is before me, and I would have to consider the arguments, and they might be different arguments from the arguments that were available in 1985.
Sir, I'm not asking you about case law.
So here, Schumer, he's like a dog on a pant leg. He's not going to let go of this thing.
Now, maybe you read a case and it changed your view of the Constitution. I'm asking you, and not about the process you'd used, I'm asking you about your view of the Constitution, because as we all know, and we're going to talk about stare decisis in a few minutes, that if somebody believes, a judge, especially a Supreme Court justice, that something is unconstitutional, even though stare decisis is on the books, is governs the way you are, and there's precedent on the books for decades, it's still important to know your view of what the Constitution contains.
See, his point there being just what I just said a minute ago, that stare decisis, you know, that the court had ruled that segregation should be legal. The court had ruled, there's all kinds of things that the court has ruled. The court has reversed itself on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, maximum hour, numbers of hours that can be worked laws. These have all come before the court. They've been stare decisis for a while, and the court reverses them. It's not uncommon thing. So Schumer is saying, just tell us what you believe. Do you really believe the Constitution says that there is no constitutional right to an abortion?
And let me just say, a few hours ago, in the same memo, I can't remember who asked the question, but you said you backed off one of the statements you had written. You said it was inapt, which taught me something. I didn't know that there was a word that was inapt, but you said that it was inapt to have written that the elected branches are supreme. So you discussed that, your view on that issue, without reference to case law, because there was no reference to case law when you wrote it. There was no reference to case law when you wrote this. Can you tell us your view, just one more time, your view about the Constitution not protecting a right to an abortion, which you have talked about before, and you said you personally proudly held that view. Can you?
The question about the supremacy, the statement about the supremacy of the elected branches
went to my understanding of
the constitutional structure of our country. And so certainly that's a subject it is proper for me to talk about. But the only way, you are asking me how I would decide.
I'm not. I'm asking you what you believe in the Constitution.
Why is the headline in every newspaper in America today not, why are they not running headlines that say, Alito manages to weasel out of the biggest question of our day, or one of the biggest questions of our day?
You're asking me my view of a question that...
I'm not asking about a question. I'm asking about the Constitution, in all due respect, and something you wrote about before.
The Constitution contains the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment and the 14th Amendment. It provides protection for liberty. It provides substantive protection.
Oh, yeah, and the Constitution says that the president is the commander-in-chief. I mean, you know, come on.
The Supreme Court has told us what the standard is for determining whether something falls within the scope of
the protection. Does the Constitution protect the right to free speech?
Sure. Certainly it does. That's
well, why can't you answer that the question of does the Constitution protect the right to an abortion the same way without talking about stare decisis, without talking about cases, etc.?
Because answering the question of whether the Constitution provides a right to free speech is simply responding to whether there is language in the First Amendment that says that the freedom of speech and freedom of the press can't be abridged. Asking about the issue of abortion has to do with the interpretation of certain provisions of the Constitution.
Well, okay. I know you're not going to answer the question. I didn't expect really that you would, although I think it would be important that you would.
There you go. And the reason why that interchange was not on ABC, CBS, NBC, MSNBC, CNN was because it runs 4 minutes and 50 seconds. And it requires a little bit of background to understand. It doesn't lend itself to a 10-second soundbite. And in our infotainment America, this is the tragedy of the mainstream media news right now. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Lie down, people. Lay down your Bill of Rights. Tell James Madison we had to let those amendments go.
9 minutes before the hour, welcome back to the vast radical middle conspiracy. Take no imitations, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Gary in Sydney, Nebraska on the line. Hey, Gary, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Good to talk to you. Let me follow up with your question about your comment about Senator Schumer. I wish he would have followed up and used, instead of the word speech, does it protect your right to receive a lung transplant? What about a heart transplant? What about a brain transplant? Something that is equally not specifically talked about, but is, you know, accepted practice today.
Right. Does the Constitution protect your right to have an appendectomy?
Yeah. Yeah. What I actually called in was about Lindsey Graham. You know, I was disgusted yesterday when I heard about him going to the House to help out with that. I was equally disgusted with the question that he gave, because I believe it's almost like he was trying to set this guy up, you know, to make him look better and to let the White House off the hook for today.
Oh, yeah, he was tossing talking points to Alito.
I mean,
that's what Lindsey Graham was doing.
Questions that he was asking were specific questions that was going to let the White House off the hook for the situation that it's in. In a time of war, we've got, you know, extra rules that apply here.
Right.
Almost, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, what I actually called to ask you for is, do we have specific proof, or what is our source that he actually went to the White House to help out?
That Lindsey Graham was there helping coach Alito. It's been reported by several of the news media. I don't have any, you know, independent corroboration of it. I don't think it's being disputed by Graham.
I wish these places, you know, were to express themselves a little more, you know, with a little more validation of what they're saying, because there is so much, you know, negative, so much baloney flying around.
Yeah. No, I got it, Gary. You're absolutely right. And what Lindsey Graham did, assuming that he did it in going to the White House and coaching Alito, was not illegal. It's simply highly improper. I mean, this is something that we should all be concerned about. Dr. Beth in Highlands, North Carolina.
Hello.
Hi, hello. You are live and on the air, Dr. Beth.
Yes. I've been concerned about, I'm hearing the same thing from people that I heard during the Watergate hearings, that is, that they're all crooks.
Right.
And so why bother? And right. I remembered a phrase that I had copied down from a New Yorker editorial referring to this as the easy sophistication of the powerless. In
right.
other words, you can say smugly, oh, I know all about it, and they're all crooks, and so...
Right.
And therefore,
I can't do anything. And that's why, Beth, it's so important that I play this clip every single day. I'm going to do it right now for just a minute. It's 24 seconds, if you can just hold for just a second.
There are no Democrats who took money from Jack Abramoff. Not one. Not one single Democrat. Every person named in this scandal is a Republican. Every person under investigation is a Republican. Every person indicted is a Republican. This is a Republican finance scandal. There is no evidence that Jack Abramoff ever gave any Democrat any money. And we've looked through all those FEC reports to make sure that's true.
This is Howard Dean.
I know the Republican National Committee would like to get the Democrats involved in this. They're scared. They should be scared. They haven't told the truth. They have misled the American people. And now it appears they're stealing from Indian tribes. The Democrats are not involved in this.
There you go.
Well,
and we need to spread the word.
My question is there any way that instead of continuing to reiterate who did take bribes from Abramoff or is suspected, is there any way we could have a list of people we know did not do so? Because this is what I did during the Watergate hearing.
Every Democrat did not.
I knew some doggone good, honest politicians back in Ohio, and I would say, these people are honest. Oh, well, they're all crooks.
Yeah. So, well, Beth, you make a really great point, and it would be great to have a list of Republicans who did not take money from Abramoff. I don't know if such a list exists, but I can tell you that one simple list is every single Democrat. Not one took money from Abramoff. Danny in Elizabethtown, Kentucky, and thank you for calling, Dr. Beth. Danny in Elizabethtown, Kentucky, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Just wanted to ask you real quick about the case that Patrick Leahy brought up yesterday morning about the 10-year-old girl, the search warrant, the strip search.
Right.
If you could just tell us what the name of that case was and just your thoughts and opinions on how it, the greater meaning of it all with what's going on right now in the Fourth Amendment. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you, Danny. I appreciate the call. I don't have that case right in front of me, so I can't tell you what the name of the case is. I thought I did. It's somewhere here in my stack. But no, I'm sorry, I don't. But the bottom line is that Alito basically said that because there was this guy who was a drug dealer, and they had a warrant for him and for his home. And so they could search him and they could search his home. And the cops also searched his wife and his daughter and did a strip search of them. And the reason they gave was that they thought that he might have hidden drugs on these people. And the court ruled that, sorry, you got to have a separate warrant. If you're going to strip search another human being, you have to have a separate warrant for that human being. And Alito said, well, you know, he could have stashed the drugs on them. It should be, you know, up to the police. And Alito lost actually on that one. And because the bottom line is that you have to have a warrant. But Alito has, this is just an example of Alito always sucking up to power. And when Alito said that, and Alito kind of defended it, and then Leahy, who had been a prosecutor, by the way, and a prosecuting attorney, and understands the criminal justice system, said, no, I'm sorry, you know, you're wrong. You would routinely get another warrant. You could hold them temporarily. You could hold them at the site. You could take them in as material witnesses, whatever. You could hold them and then get a warrant and then search them. But you have to do these things legally. We live in a land of laws. But when it comes to laws for the rich and powerful, Sam Alito seems to think that there's a whole separate set of rules. We'll continue this conversation after the break, after the news at the top of the hour. We're going to have Jeffrey Feldman on. He's the editor-in-chief of Frame Shop is Open. And we're going to talk with Jeff for 5 or 10 minutes about what the frames are that the Republicans are using on this. And we'll get back to your phone calls and more discussion of what's going on with Mr. Alito yesterday, today, the whole thing, and the large issues that are at stake here. It's 57 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friend, to the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Jeffrey Feldman is with us. FrameShopIsOpen.com is website. Jeffrey, one of the nation's preeminent parsers of frames, those neuro-linguistic programming NLP techniques for causing you to think something that may not be quite so. Hey, Jeffrey.
Hi, Tom.
Great to have you with us. What are the main frames that the Republicans are using right now with regard to Alito and just in general? What are you seeing out there?
Well, what I'm seeing initially was this...
Or hearing or feeling.
Well, I'm hearing and feeling. First of all, was this idea of mainstream as a frame, which first started to get articulated around Sunday. I heard it on Meet the Press that had an interview with Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, and John Cornyn, Republican from Texas. And both of them seemed to be arguing that the issue with Alito was not his ability as a judge, not his loyalty to the president, but whether or not he was within the mainstream. In fact, there were so many streams that these guys were talking about, it sounded more like a conversation about whitewater rafting than the White House nominee,
right.
Which was extremely discouraging. Subsequently, the president started to talk about dignity and class. This idea that the important thing about Alito was that he was a man of good behavior, and that what was important about the process in the Senate was not whether it discovered anything concrete about Alito's perspectives on the Constitution, but whether or not all the senators behaved themselves well.
Now, a frame that I've noticed in the last couple of days is the frame of, is it modesty or propriety? Moderateness. I mean, there seems to be a series of words here that are being used, particularly with regard to Alito, that he came from a modest upbringing, that his father was, you know, I've caught that word several times. Do you see that as an emerging frame?
It has come up a lot, and there's been a staging in the Senate of Alito's modesty. They have put his family behind him. from his elderly mother-in-law, I believe, all the way to his children. And the Republican senators have repeatedly referenced those members of his family. I think that the idea, the big thing that the senators were concerned about, the Republicans anyway, was that Alito, who has a reputation for being somewhat arrogant, would reveal that in the proceedings, that he would look like Judge Bork a few years back, who came across as very, very arrogant. And so at every turn, they've made an attempt to talk about his very modest background, to show him as a very modest person. And at one point, during his opening statement, rather than talking about his judicial perspective, he told this Horatio Alger, up from nothing story, a boy raised in a small town from Italian immigrant parents who eventually ends up going to Princeton and living out the American dream. So it was quite a performance in order to get that idea out there.
Right, a lot of work on that. It's just for the benefit of our listeners who may not understand what a frame is, you're on the program regularly and we talk about these things, but it's probably useful to kind of reset this from time to time. What is framing and how is it used?
Well, frames are the broad conceptual logic that provide the rules, as it were, for how it is that we discuss issues. Frames are different than facts because frames, they set the landscape and determine what we think is good and bad or right or wrong. So if you are stuck inside your opponent's frame, it's almost impossible to argue your way out of it. You need to reset the terms of the debate in order to frame things. And the Republicans for years now have been hiring highly paid consultants in order to establish the rules for the debate. And every time there's a big issue that comes up in the Congress or the Senate or the President has somebody he wants to push, he uses what I call magic words in order to invoke these broad concepts and ideas. So in this case, that's a classic example with the Alito nomination, that the president, in the days before the nomination proceedings, starts to use the word dignity and the word class in order to talk about these things. And what that does is that determines that the debate will be about the rules of behavior in the Senate rather than about Alito's specific ideas about the Constitution. And so long as the president's opponents accept those terms, they are destined to lose that debate.
Now, yesterday, George W. Bush warned critics of his Iraq policy that they risked, quote, giving comfort to our adversaries, end quote. And he also suggested that Democrats who did give comfort to our adversaries implicitly by criticizing him and his policies in Iraq would suffer at the ballot box in November. This is a frame.
It's absolutely a frame. It's something that I call the irresponsible frame. And the logic is that criticism of the Iraq war hurts our troops. And the purpose of setting the debate in these terms is to get Democrats to stand up and say, we support the troops. We are not being irresponsible. And to not actually talk about what's important to the American people, but simply to defend themselves against this accusation that they're being irresponsible.
So what's the appropriate way for the Democrats to reply to this frame that Bush has put out? Because you call it, I forget the word that you just used for the frame. What was it again?
A broad conceptual logic.
No, I mean the irresponsible frame. Is that what
you
call
it? Right. That's
the irresponsible frame. I call it the Nazi frame. this is the, you know, you're with me or you're against me, you're evil or you're good. I mean, this is the in any case, how should the Democrats, and others, and progressives, Greens, whatever, respond to such a thing?
Well, we should respond, first of all, by not defending ourselves against this charge. Instead, what we need to do is talk about what I call the moral accounting in the war, and use the phrase in particular, Americans have paid the price. I think it's important for Americans for Democrats to remind the public that what's going to happen in 2006 is that Americans who have paid the price for this war are going to they deserve to be heard, and that's what.
That's a great frame. That's a great frame, the paid the price frame, and it's also it's a double entendre. We've paid the price both in blood and in money.
Exactly, and the big issue I think that bothers a lot of Americans is that here we have a president who represents the upper crust of American society, and who talks about the sacrifice of American families, and yet at the same time seems to be insulating his cronies and his peer set from paying any price at all. They benefit economically, they benefit politically, and at every turn the president seems to ignore who is paying the price. And that's what the election needs to be about. not some return to the accusatory campaign politics of the Vietnam War era, but a really strong debate about the people having the right to be heard.
Well, Bush even tries to take it back before that. I mean, he's been using rhetoric out of World War II. And, in fact, on occasion, he has invoked Franklin Roosevelt. And I'm just amazed that the Democrats haven't come forward and said, hey, wait a minute, during World War II, Franklin Roosevelt had four sons. All four of them enlisted. Three of them were in combat. You know, and Bush. I mean, you know, why hasn't anybody, well, I guess here the larger question. Jeffrey Feldman we're speaking with. Frameshopisopen.com is his website. And be sure to put the is open part in there, because just frameshop.com is a porn site. Frameshopisopen.com. And Jeffrey Feldman, how do we convince the Democratic Party that they need to understand these foundational tools of communication and use them appropriately, that it's not some evil manipulation, that it's simply effective communication?
I think that we need to get out there, as many of us who are working from the ground up need to get out there, put these tools into practice, and build a base that is literate in these concepts. When that starts to happen, then I think that the Democratic leadership will start to see that these types of tools really work on the ground. In the meantime, they're going to listen to high-paid consultants who are saying, use this program that I've crafted, and it should work.
The Bob Schrums of the world, you mean?
The Bob Schrums,
the ones who keep leading them to defeat?
The ones that keep leading them to defeat, who also use communication techniques, but their idea tends to be to impose these notions on people rather than teaching people to use these tools to their advantage on the everyday level.
Yeah, they tend to be using communication techniques grounded in the 1920s, too. We have about a minute left. Jeffrey Feldman with frameshopisopen.com. What are the frames you see on the horizon? You see anything popping its head up here?
Well, as you talked about before, I think that the president has opened the first battle in the election for 2006, and I think this is going to be the week when the president returns to accusing the Democrats of really hurting the troops. And as we talked about before, we need to be very careful not to go back on the defensive. I think that it's important to call Alito the president's man rather than a man of the people. And I think it's important for Democrats to talk about, talk for people who have paid the price rather than people who are at the top.
Use the paid the price frame over and over. I find that interesting. You're suggesting that Bush has just kicked off the 2006 campaign. Nobody else that I've talked with has suggested that, but it makes perfect sense.
Seems to be what happened at the Veterans for Foreign War speech in D.C. yesterday. It really was amazing to hear him fire the first volley in the election. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting to see how many other Republicans pick this up, because there have been Republicans who have been critical of what he said. You know, Chuck Hagel and company. How do they escape being caught in that frame?
It'll be interesting to see who runs and see who follows.
Yeah, it will. Jeffrey Feldman, frameshopisopen.com, the website. Jeffrey, as always, great to have you on the program.
Thanks, Tom, for being
with us. Good talking with you. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where reason is our lifestyle choice. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where being progressive never felt so good. The case, by the way, the Scriptures case that the person called about in the last hour was Doe versus Grudy, or Grudy, G-R-O-O-D-Y. And in that case, Alito argued the police officers had not violated constitutional rights when they strip-searched a mother and her 10-year-old daughter while carrying out a search warrant that authorized only the search of a man in his home. So that's Sam Alito's America. Welcome back. Welcome to it. And it may be coming soon to a town near you. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. Victoria, what's happening there?
Well, of course, the Alito hearings are the talk of the town, if you want to call it that. Now, of course, Alito's argument is that this particular drug dealer was known to hide his drugs on family members, actually physically on their bodies. That was known. And so he says that as the warrant was drawn up by police officers who might not know all the legal ins and outs, clearly this is what they intended, and any reasonable person would have interpreted it that way.
Well, if that's what they intended, it should have been what they said.
Yeah.
And they certainly have legal basis if they think that somebody is holding drugs. To not strip search them right then and there, but to hold them. I mean, you can hold somebody as a material witness. You can hold somebody under suspicion, take them down to the police department, get a warrant, and then do the search.
See, this is why I didn't understand entirely when Senator Leahy brought this up yesterday, and Alito gave the reply I just gave you, and then it went on a bit, and, you know, Leahy said he didn't think that was what a reasonable man would do. I thought to myself, so go ahead and push him and say that why don't you hold them and have them searched at the police station? But that just seemed logical to me anyway,
right.
And he didn't go there.
Well, Leahy didn't say that, I think, and this is the problem that so many senators have, or so many people in Washington, D.C., professional politicians, is because he's a lawyer. He used to be a prosecutor. He's surrounded by lawyers. He's interviewing a lawyer, and he's not thinking about the camera and Joe Sixpack at home who's watching this thing. He's responding to legal questions, and he's just assuming everybody knows that that was a stupid response from Alito, and that what you and I just said is how it would normally be done. I mean, so I think that's, you know, to the extent that I want to defend Pat Leahy, which is pretty slim right now. I know Pat Leahy, and I think very highly of him as a senator and as a human being. But all of these Democrats on this committee should be kicking this guy's butt a whole lot harder than they are. I understand Senator Kennedy got in a little bit of a battle with Mr. Spector this morning.
Yes, he wants the records from the concerned alumni of Princeton, and these are records that are not already published, but that obviously exist. I don't know exactly what he's looking for because I wasn't able to hear all his testimony. Clearly, he's looking for something that's going to be damaging to Alito, and there was a big fight about whether he could subpoena them, whether they should be subpoenaed, whether he'd asked for them before, and it just all got really very, very snippy.
Yeah, the Concerned Alumni of Princeton, CAP, for our listeners who may not know, is a group that Alito had joined. In fact, he listed only two groups that he'd ever had membership with, that and the Federalist Society. In my mind, the Federalist Society is enough to disqualify him in and of itself. But in any case, he said that, and the Concerned Alumni of Princeton, apparently, from what I've been able to read, was either formed or at least at this point in time had as its major issue the fact that what they were concerned about was that there were increasing numbers of African Americans and women who were getting admitted to Princeton.
Correct. And Senators Bill Frist and Bradley had already disavowed themselves from it, and in fact had fairly roundly denounced it. So it's not like it wasn't known. Alito's given the impression that he was so out of touch with it that he didn't know any of this.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas others, there were other issues, of course, whether or not there should be ROTC on campus and things like that. So what else do you see happening there in Washington, D.C. today?
Well,
how's this all going to play out?
Well, they're going to have to decide if they're going to go into tomorrow, and they're in their 20-minute round, and it's going slowly. So I think they're either going to go until late tonight, or they may have to go into tomorrow. That is if any of the senators want a third round, and that's going to be the big question for the Democrats. Do they want a third round, or are they really flogging a dead horse? I'm a horse lover, so I probably shouldn't have said that.
Yeah.
Everybody gets the image.
Sure.
You know, because are they going to get anything out of this man? And if they aren't, is it in fact counterproductive to keep going after him and to be seen to be not getting anywhere?
It seems to me that the Democratic machine has pretty much already rolled over. For example, yesterday when Schumer just for 4.5 minutes over and over and over again kept asking Alito, do you still believe, as you wrote in 1985, that the Constitution contains no right to an abortion? Do you still believe that? And Alito kept refusing to answer and refusing to answer and refusing to answer. And finally Schumer says, well, I guess you're just not going to answer. The whole Democratic machine should have been out there banging on the doors of all the media saying, you know, having boiled that down to a soundbite and said, here it is. And, you know, it wasn't on any headlines I saw this morning.
No, it wasn't on any headlines I saw, and that was some of the, apart from anything else, it was some of the liveliest testimony, and just from a purely theatrical point of view, you'd think that people would want to play it.
Yeah, but the Democrats don't seem to be pushing it, and I suspect that it's because they think that this is a fiat accompli, that this guy is going to get nominated and confirmed. He's already been nominated. He's going to get confirmed, and they don't want to take the heat for being, you know, the confirmation. They can't make him look too bad and then vote for him. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Everybody's talking, no one says a word. Everybody's making love. No one really cares. There's Nazis in the bathroom just below the stairs.
And welcome back.
Always something happening and nothing going on. There's always something cooking and nothing in the pot.
It's 34 minutes past the hour. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass destruction. Tom Hartman here with you. First, Alito tries to pass off his 1985 statement that he strongly believes that the Constitution, and he's proud to believe that the Constitution does not protect a right to an abortion. Excuse me. First, he tries to pass off this statement as the opinion of the Reagan administration. Schumer says, no, wait a minute. You said you believed this personally. Next, he says it would be inappropriate to state an opinion because it might come before the court. Schumer says, I'm not asking you about an opinion. You have an obligation to talk about this. You previously stated your belief. Then he tries to hide behind stare decisis, you know, in other words, past rulings, precedent. And so Schumer drags out a chart filled with dozens of instances in which Alito's colleagues had criticized Alito for ignoring stare decisis, for ignoring precedent. Basically, he stripped the bark off this guy. I mean, he stripped his clothes off. Here's Alito. He's got nothing. And didn't make the news, as far as I can tell. Maybe you heard something. But I think that other than folks who were watching C-SPAN, and why? Why is the Democratic machine not behind this? I think it's because they've decided that this guy is going to get confirmed, and if they demonize him too much, then they're going to look like real wimps, which they are, tragically. They should be fighting for this is the next generation. This is the next 20 years on the bench, and here's this guy who is an extreme right-wing crank. I mean, it doesn't get any farther right. He's a guy who wrote that Robert Bork was one of the finest nominees who had ever been set up for the Supreme Court, who'd ever been sent up by the president to Capitol Hill for confirmation. No, I kid you not. He said that about Robert Bork. Ruth Ann in New Albany, Indiana. Hey, Ruth Ann, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Tom. Before I ask my question about the Howard Dean clip that you played,
yeah,
I just want to let you know that Bush definitely is on the campaign trail because he was supposed to be in our little town today,
mm-hmm,
campaigning for 9th District Congressman Mike Fodrell, but our Republican Governor Mitch Daniels was, quote, not available to be at the rally with the president. So he moved it across the river to Louisville. So that's where he is today.
Oh, that's interesting. So yeah, Now we have Republicans who are trying to distance themselves from Bush?
It sounds like it. Although Mitch Daniels, you know, was his first budget director.
Yeah, so yeah.
I don't know what happened there. But anyway, my question is, you played the clip, Howard Dean, about the Abramoff and the Democrats.
Right.
And I certainly hope that's true, but did you know that Chris Matthews on Hardball has been running a crawl at the bottom of the screen every day, and he's got Democrats' names and how much they got from Abramoff,
yeah,
including, I saw Max Baucus, it was just like $1,000, but there were a couple others, and I can't remember who they were, but...
I haven't seen that on Chris Matthews. I can tell you that the Republican talking point is the money that they got from Abramoff. It's the money that they got from Abramoff and his associates.
And his associates.
And the way that it works, I mean, you've got these Indian tribes out here who have become industries in some ways, you know, the gambling industry. Mm-hmm. And for a long time, I mean, for decades, they have been lobbying independently. They've been giving money to politicians of all kinds. And in some states, I mean, you know, Nevada, for example, Harry Reid's place, it's a big business. I mean, you got an Indian tribe, you got casinos, you got gambling. Of course, you would expect them in a system which I think needs to be fixed, but nonetheless, here it is, a system where lobbying actually does produce results. You would expect them to be giving money to these members of Congress. So then, you know, along comes the Bush administration and the K Street project and a lot of people like Tom DeLay saying, unless you give money exclusively to Republicans, I won't even talk to you anymore. Right. And so you've got some Indian tribes who hired Jack Abramoff. But before they hired Jack Abramoff, they may have been giving money to some of the Democrats. Right. And even after they hired Jack Abramoff, perhaps even against his advice, they continued to give some money to Democrats. But that's not money that Abramoff gave to Democrats. Well, Abramoff had been he'd been the head of the Young Republicans when he was in college. He was absolutely part of the whole K Street Project thing. His philosophy was you only give money to Republicans, period. So I'll bet you that Chris Matthews...
And who's in power? Obviously, you're going to give the money to where the power is that can do something.
Well, yes and no. I mean, if you go back and you look, for example, on an industry-by-industry basis, and one of Ralph Nader's groups, I believe it's citizen.org. In fact, I'm quite sure it's citizen.org. I just can't remember what the acronym, you know, what the Americans for Concerned Citizens of America, whatever it is. They have listings of who gave to what campaigns that goes back, you know, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And what you find is that up until about 8 or 10 years ago, pretty much everybody was an equal opportunity corrupter, to paraphrase George W. Bush. I mean, you know, you had Dow Chemical given to both Democrats and Republicans. Everybody was playing both sides of the street. Now, particularly over the last 5 years, since it became a really organized campaign, but particularly over the last 10 years, it's been mostly, you know, the more corrupting, the dirty industries, for example, you know, the petroleum, the chemical industries and whatnot, have been giving very, very heavily to the Republicans, leaving the Democrats with nothing but money from the labor unions, who, by the way, used to give money to Republicans as well, because that's, you know, what you do if you want them to take your phone call.
Mm-hmm.
And so there has been this divide. But my guess would be, and I'll have to check this out, my guess would be that Chris Matthews is using the Republican talking point strategy of saying Abramoff and his associates, as opposed to just Jack Abramoff, because Howard Dean actually went through the FEC filings, and yesterday morning, James Carville was on, I forget which program it was, but, 4 o'clock in the morning here in Portland, James Carville was on saying, there are no Democrats who took money from Jack Abramoff. Really? He wouldn't give money to Democrats.
Well, the way Chris Matthews and Nora Donnell were painting it last night, it's like, this is, you know, both sides. This is not...
Well, that's the Republican meme, and Chris Matthews knows that if he wants to stay in business at NBC, at this huge defense contractor, a company that fired their most profitable program, the Phil Donahue Show, more profitable than Chris Matthews was at the time,
mm-hmm.
their number one most profitable program, most watched and most profitable program, simply because of his political views. Mm-hmm. If he's gonna keep a job on that network, he's gotta pay the piper.
And every once in a while, he throws a bone, you know, to make it look like he's
right.
You know, bipartisan, but there's a question in my mind anyway.
No, well, it's absolutely.
But I don't want Howard Dean to have, you know, said this incorrectly. I want this to be true. So if there's some way you can find out and clarify, you know, how that.
Carville verified it yesterday, and I'm just assuming that it's true, and that if the chairman of the DNC is saying it, I'm believing it, because he's the last person who wants to put his foot in his mouth again, right?
Exactly.
And then, by the way, speaking of MSNBC, from noon until 4 o'clock yesterday Eastern time, which would be 3 to 7 o'clock Pacific time, here's who they had on MSNBC as their political analysts covering these mm-hmm. hearings. Pat Buchanan, former Republican presidential candidate. Ed Gillespie, former RNC chairman, who, by the way, is serving as the White House advisor for Alito's nomination process.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Frist, the Republican leader of the Senate.
Okay.
No Democrats, no progressives, none.
For four hours.
That's right. For the 4 hours of the four main primetime hours of the hearings, that's all they had on. Then they interviewed Nora O'Donnell, who interviewed Buchanan three times. Nora Donnell, of course, is the White House correspondent. And I'm telling you, you know, Nora's got a very good salary. She's got a very good job. And she knows if she wants to keep that job, if she asks one tough question of George W. Bush or says one really and truly, quote, bad thing, end quote, about the White House, that she'll never be called on again. She's going to lose her job. And she'll be back, you know, trying to get a $30,000, $40,000 a year job at a local TV station instead of the $400,000 or $500,000 a year job that she's got with a major network.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, she knows which side her bread is buttered on. And so she's interviewing Chris Pat Buchanan and NBC News correspondent Pete Williams. Again, same problem. In fact, he's even quoting this Republican lie that Alito was following Sandra Day O'Connor's precedent about spousal notification on abortions. So anyhow, Ruth Ann, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank
it's great to hear from you. Paula in Bayonne, New Jersey. Hey, Paula, what's up?
Hey, Tom. About this Alito thing.
Yeah.
What I would love, and it's not going to happen, but what I would love is for one of the Democrats on the Judiciary Committee to, you know, open a question by listing the inconsistencies in Alito's statements about his affiliation with the CAP.
Right.
Why he believed things. His record of dishonesty with the Judiciary Committee, going back to his appointment to the Third Circuit Court.
Yeah.
And then just ask him, why should we believe you?
Well, it would be a good one. And in fact, if you've been watching this thing on C-SPAN, actually some of the Democrats have been asking these kind of tough questions. But Alito just has been either weaseling out of things, refusing to answer questions, having bad memories. I think, frankly, you know, yes, I'm holding the Democrats to account at a certain level on this, but I think the press is doing most of the water carrying for Alito on this.
They're just horrible, and this whole thing that he was coached by members of the Republican members of the Judiciary Committee. Government. I'm not an expert. I'm no legal expert, but that just seems wrong.
Yeah, yeah. What's wrong with this picture? Very well said. And it goes. In fact, it goes beyond seems wrong, Paula. It is wrong. I mean, it's not. It may not necessarily be illegal, but for Lindsey Graham to be one of the guys who's coaching and rehearsing Alito, it's just over the top. Paula, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate your calling in. It's good to hear from you. Our telephone number here 866-440-8466. Drop into our live chat room at TomHartmann.com if you'd like. It's the Tom Hartmann Radio Program, the real democracy zone, the real free speech zone. No barbed wire, no cops going to drag you off with a no oil for blood bumper sticker.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartmann.
And welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartmann here with you. The place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. We're going to take it over, right? There you go. Bob Mendocino, California. You part of the conspiracy, Bob?
I'm a very outraged citizen of this country. I'm sitting here watching, listening to these hearings, and not hearing the word corporatism being brought up. It seems to me that someplace Benito Mussolini's smiling. You know, I'm really concerned, Tom. What are we going to do about this?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and it doesn't seem that there's a strong answer out there. The whole issue of corporatism is one that everybody's running scared of because there have been these Supreme Court decisions and principally because Reagan suspended enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act. And so now you have corporations who have such control over the media in this country and who have such control over basically the economic lifeblood of our country that it's virtually not possible that politicians can stand up to them any longer.
What should we as citizens do? What can we do? Is it time for a revolution?
Well, you know, having a revolution domestically is a whole different thing than having a revolution from, you know, a foreign occupying power. No, it's not time for a revolution. What it's time for is a great awakening. We need to awaken as many people as possible. It's the reason why I wrote the book on equal protection. It's the reason why, one of the reasons why I do this radio show. It's the reason, you know, it's what you're upset about, Bob. And the thing that is the good news, here's the good news in this. When I wrote on equal protection 4 years ago, 5 years ago, nobody that I met anywhere even knew what corporate personhood meant. You know, they didn't understand the word corporatism. The first time that I used the word fascism in an article in an op-ed piece that I wrote for Common Dreams, people soundly criticized me. I mean, I got all these emails back. This was like three and a half years ago where I was comparing, you know, the rise of Hitler, the rise of Bush, and then Mussolini, and then talking about, well, here's what fascism really is. It's not Nazism. It's corporate. It's the merging of corporations and the state. And, you know, people were criticizing me for, you know, oh, you know, you're equating Bush with Hitler, you're gonna lose credibility, blah, blah, blah. Now, people are starting to talk about these issues. I'm not taking credit for it. I think that, you know, I was on the leading edge of a trend that a lot of people are participating in. But the fact of the matter is that people are talking about it. I mean, here you are calling me, and we're talking about this on National Talk Radio. And 2, 3, 4 years ago, that there was zero. Nobody. So I think that this is a good trend. It's a beginning.
Could you ask Bernie Sanders about this when you have him on Friday?
Oh, Bernie, yeah. I mean,
throw that at him a little bit about corporatism, please.
Yeah, or in fact, why don't you call him and ask him?
Well, if I can get through, I'll give it a try.
Yeah, give it
a
shot.
Thank you very much, Tom.
You're welcome. Thank you, Bob. I appreciate the call. And I know Bernie would much rather respond to our callers than to me. So, you know, it's like it's all about the callers. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Hey, I think CNN's Lou Dobbs is a Tom Hartman listener.
Yeah, well, it's funny. Louise sent me an email from somebody quoting a transcript from Lou Dobbs, and from you. All right, and in which he's saying, "Hey, wait a minute. Are we serving the economy or are we serving the people?" And she said, "You want to read this on the air?" And I'm like, "You know, why am I reading Lou Dobbs reading me? Lou Dobbs quoting me?" But I don't think that it's so much that Lou Dobbs is listening to this program. I mean, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if he was? I think it's that what I'm saying and what Lou Dobbs is saying are just reflecting the traditional views of America. I mean, Lou Dobbs is a Republican.
Yeah.
And I'm not.
But what I've noticed, this is the second time that he has confronted a conservative, one was from the Cato Institute, and this guy trying to completely distort the political system with the economic system.
Yeah.
Reversing. And I love that he said, we are a government of the people, by the people, for the people, and that is superior to the economy.
Yeah.
And I just love it. No one ever says that.
Yeah, and
that
is their whole
Ayn Rand thing sits on top of that philosophy.
I know, and it's really a shame that Lou Dobbs is about the only guy out there who's speaking out about these issues in the national media, because number one, his show is not that widely watched. I mean, you know, a few hundred thousand people, but it's not like, you know, the NBC Evening News with Brian Williams that has millions of watchers or viewers. Mm-hmm. And number two, it's considered an economic show. Rather than a political show. I mean, you got the political shows like Chris Matthews, though, they won't touch this stuff.
Right.
Because it's radioactive, you know, if you're doing politics, because then the politician won't come on and talk to you. You know, Lou pretty much doesn't care. Anyhow, good point, Tom. I appreciate your making it. Pam in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Pam, welcome to the program. We got about a minute left.
Well, Tom, I just want to let people know a little bit more about who these guys are. He's trying to distance himself from the Princeton group, but growing up, I heard about my godfather was a member of this group. He'd been a banker. He had insider information at the time of the Depression, so he sold his stocks, and so he remained wealthy. He helped my mom's family keep going. It was her uncle.
Mm-hmm.
But he always encouraged me to go to college. Never mentioned that here he was as a Princeton graduate in this club would have stopped me from going to Princeton.
Yeah.
And then when I married a Jew, I was disinherited.
Oh, my goodness.
His money all went to Campus Crusade for Christ and Jews for Jesus. Now, this is a decent man. His, you know, the way he walked in the world, you know, he did good things. But I think people just need to understand what these people are made of. They are among us. They are part of some of our background, our families.
Sure. Yeah. These. Well, in fact, this whole conservative mindset and worldview, from, you know, on one extreme spectrum of the spectrum, anti-Semitism, to the other extreme, the belief in aristocracy. This is the Common Dreams piece that I wrote this week. If you go to commondreams.org, you'll read it. It was published on Monday. Is something that has been with this nation from its founding.
Exactly.
And this is nothing new.
Blue blood. I was raised being told that I had blue blood, so I was better than others.
Yeah.
And I can remember having arguments with my parents about the fact that, no, it's what you prove yourself to be in this lifetime.
There you go. Well said, Pam. Pam, I appreciate the call, and thank you very much. It very well said. You said it better than I could have. And these, you know, these are the issues of our time, and we need to wake up and figure out, you know, who these people are, what they are, what they are saying. What is the agenda behind Alito? What is the agenda behind the Bush administration? I'm telling you, it's the agenda of elitism, of aristocracy, pure and simple, inherited wealth and corporate power.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, Ted Kennedy is at it. Boy, is he at it. He's doing the equivalent of the old, I'm mad as hell and not going to take it anymore. And Arlen Specter is having none of it. And it's fascinating, this debate that just happened between the two of them. We'll share a little bit of it with you in just a moment. But let's just step into the Wayback Machine here for a moment and go back to December of 2005, last month, an article in the Associated Press. Senator Edward Kennedy is pressing for documents on Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito's involvement with a conservative group that argued Princeton University lowered its admission standards to accept women and minorities. In a letter on Thursday, Kennedy asked Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Arlen Specter, Republican of Pennsylvania, to make a formal request for files in the private papers of a founder and leader of concerned alumni of Princeton. In view of CAP's troubling opposition to equal educational opportunity for women, minorities, and the disabled, wrote Kennedy, it is important for the committee to learn more about Judge Alito's involvement in this organization. Alito said last month that he did not recall any involvement with the group, which two decades ago sparked controversy by saying school officials had lowered the Ivy League university's admission standards to allow enrollment of women and minorities. Now, here's why this is significant. This doesn't just stand alone. In his famous 1985 job application in which he talked about abortion, he also referenced essentially the same thing, the same issue. He not only listed the fact that he was a member of concerned alumni of Princeton University, a conservative alumni group, but he also said, and I quote, I'm quoting Sam Alito himself, I am particularly proud of my contributions in recent cases in which the government has argued in the Supreme Court that racial and ethnic quotas should not be allowed and that the Constitution does not protect a right to an abortion. In other words, the guy is anti-affirmative action, and CAP was an anti-affirmative action group. So here you have the guy claiming that he was a member of an anti, not just minorities, but anti-woman group, and also saying that he's anti-women with regard to the right to an abortion. Kennedy, on the 23rd of December, the Associated Press reports that Kennedy has sent this letter to Arlen Specter. Just a few moments ago, Kennedy put into the record a copy of the letter from Arlen Specter back to him acknowledging that Specter had received his request. Okay, so there's no disputing that back in, you know, weeks ago, Ted Kennedy said to Arlen Specter, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee that's interrogating Alito right now, Sam Alito, said, you know, we'd like to see the records of this group back when he was a member, to see if he attended meetings, to see if he had anything to say about these issues. What was he up to? Why was he so proud of being a member that he listed on his job application in 1985? And we see here that Arlen Specter answered Ted Kennedy's letter. And as I said, the answer to that letter has just been put into the record. But here is the original, shall we say, discussion between the two of them, Ted Kennedy and Arlen Specter.
Last month, I sent a letter to Senator Specter asking a number of questions about your membership in CAP. I asked Senator Specter to make a formal committee request for the documents in the possession of the Library of Congress as part of the William Rusher papers. Mr. Rusher was the publisher of the National Review, was an active founder and leader of CAP. Do you have any hesitancy, a reason for us not to look at those documents?
They're not my documents, Senator, and I have no.
You think they would be helpful
about
to us?
It whatsoever?
You think they'd be helpful?
As Senator, I don't believe I had any active member, any active involvement with this group.
Well,
I've racked my memory, and I can't recall anything. And if I had been involved actively in any way in the group, I'm sure that I would remember.
Well, so Kennedy says, so this is Alito saying, I know nothing. And so Kennedy says, well, fine, let's get the papers and check it out.
Mr. Chairman, if I could have your attention, I think we ought to vote on issuing a subpoena to the custodian of those CAP records. And I want to do that at an appropriate time. I'd move that the committee go into executive session for the purpose of voting on the issuing of the sole purpose for issuing the subpoena of those.
And so here's Kennedy saying, you know, we want to get the records. Let's just take a break here for a second, take a vote on whether or not the committee's willing to go along with this. I told you about this a couple of weeks ago. I sent a letter to you. You've actually, and as I said, just a few minutes ago on the Senate floor, Kennedy, I don't have the clip of that, the one that just happened, but just a few minutes ago, Kennedy released the actual copy of Spector's response to his letter. Now, Arlen Spector has been receiving chemotherapy. It's possible that he was just out to lunch. I mean, I want to give him that, that Spector, you know, it's got to be very, very difficult recovering from cancer. And but Spector, boy, this became, and this is apparently a big deal. And Arlen Spector is like so wired into the Republican establishment, he is not going to let anything defeat this nomination. And if this might be a threat to it, he's not going to tolerate. Well, here, make up your own mind on this.
There are many requests which are coming to me in many quarters. And quite candidly, I view the request, if it's really a matter of importance, you and I see each other all the time, and you've never mentioned it to me. And I do not ascribe a great deal of weight. We actually didn't get a letter, but...
You did get a letter, are you saying?
Well, now, wait a minute. You don't know what I got. I'm about
to... Of course I do, sir. Senator, since I sent it.
Well, the sender doesn't necessarily know what the recipient gets, Senator Kennedy.
I've got it right.
You are not in the position to say what I receive. If you'll bear with me for just 1 minute.
But I am in a position to say what I sent to you on December 22nd.
Well, you're in a position to tell me what you sent.
I renew my request, Senator, and if I'm going to be denied, then I'd appeal the decision of the chair. I think we are entitled to this information. It deals with the fundamental issues of equality and discrimination. This nominee has indicated he has no objection to us seeing these issues. We've gone over the questions, and we are entitled to get that kind of information. And if you're going to rule it out of order, I want to have a vote on that here.
It's just very straightforward. Here's Kennedy saying, hey, you know, the Alito says he's got no problem with us asking for it. I've asked you for it. I sent you a letter asking for it. And Spector just goes, he goes bananas. I mean, he just goes right off the edge.
Sure, on our committee.
Well, don't be premature, Senator Kennedy. I'm not about to make a ruling on this state of the record. I hope you won't mind if I consider it, and I hope you won't mind if I give you the specifics that there was no letter which I received. I take umbrage if you're telling me what I received. I don't mind your telling me what you mailed. But there's a big difference between what's mailed and what's received, and you know that. We're going to move on now.
Well, Senator Mr. Chairman.
Wait a minute. No, I'm not.
Appeal the ruling of the chair on this.
There's been no ruling of the chair, Senator.
But what is the request is that we go into the executive session for the sole purpose of voting on a subpoena for these records that are held over at the Library of Congress. That purpose and that purpose only. And if I'm going to be denied that, I'd want to give notice to the chair that you're going to have it again and again and again, and we're going to have votes of this committee again and again and again until we have a resolution.
I think Kennedy feels like he's got his teeth into some meat here. He's got something.
Senator Kennedy, I'm not concerned about your threats to have votes again, again, and again. And I'm the chairman of this committee, and I have heard your request, and I will consider it. And I'm not going to have you run this committee and decide when we're going to go into executive session. We're in the middle of a round of hearings. This is the first time you have personally called it to my attention, and this is the first time that I have focused on it. And I will consider it in due course. And now we'll move to Senator Grassley for 20 minutes.
Bang, he slams the gavel down and says, that's that. You know, we're not gonna have any more conversations about this. And, you know, I understand from my sources, David over here monitoring the hearings and whatnot, that Kennedy is going to be bringing it up again and again. We'll see how this thing plays out. This could be the little bit of drama today that makes its way into the news, or maybe not. I mean, I thought yesterday when I watched Alito being grilled by Schumer, that was going to be the lead story in all the news. You know, I thought, this is it. He's nailed it. You know, Alito refuses to answer the question, do you think that there's a right to an abortion in the Constitution or not? You know, do you think that the Constitution does not protect? In other words, do you think that Roe v. Wade was correctly decided? He refused to answer the question. And then he was confronted with times in the past where Scalia and Thomas had lied to the committee over and over and over again in a very similar fashion by Schumer. And he just kind of sat there, grinning. And then, you know, Schumer says, you going to tell us? No, not going to tell you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Moving down the highway, you can hear the engine humming. Coming down the byways, you can feel the motor running.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. The place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And dare to say, no, don't think so. Sorry, Charlie, not here. Nope, not in America. Not in the America that I know. Lochner versus New York is a Supreme Court case that probably not very many of you have ever heard of. It was, and the reason why is a simple one. It was decided in 1905. But it began a hard turn to the right on the Supreme Court that the Federalist Society and Alito and Thomas and Scalia, that these guys are, and Roberts, are all about trying to recreate. They're all about trying to turn the court once again back into the Lochner type of court. Now, the Lochner decision was the beginning of a series of decisions that lasted from 1905 up until 1937, when the court became more liberal, shall we say. And oddly enough, it wasn't the result of the fact that Franklin Roosevelt was president in 1937. It was the result of the fact that Herbert Hoover had nominated three people to the Supreme Court, and they all turned out to be fairly progressive people. But in 1905, in the Lochner case, there was a law in New York State that said that bakeries could limit the number, that said that the state had the power to limit the number of hours that a baker could work in a bakery. It was basically a worker protection law. And the Supreme Court, in a 5-4 ruling, this is a very, you know, one vote ruling, ruled that the right to free contract, which was implicit in the 14th Amendment, the due process, you know, no person shall be denied equal protection under the law. It's the due process clause. That by limiting the number of hours a baker could work each week, that the state of New York was violating the 14th Amendment. Because it was, to quote the decision, the Supreme Court decision, it was an unreasonable, unnecessary, and arbitrary interference with the right and liberty of the individual to contract. In other words, if a person wants to engage in a contract with an employer, and the employer wants to hire that person, and the employer wants to hire that person for lousy wages or have them work excessive hours or have it be child labor or anything else, the state has no right to interfere in that. For a quarter, this was the beginning of laissez-faire economics in the United States again. You know, repeating it, yeah, there was a period after the Civil War, too, during Reconstruction when we had this, the Gilded Age. But in 1905, the Lochner case really began this thing. And it was followed by a whole series of them. There was the one called, in 1915, Coppedge versus Kansas, which struck down what were called yellow dog laws. Yellow dog laws were laws that said that if it was possible for an employer to agree with an employee to hire an employee only if the employee agreed not to join or associate with a labor union. And these are now illegal according to the Norris LaGuardia Act, okay, these yellow dog laws. In Adkins versus Children's Hospital in 1923, the Supreme Court held the minimum wage laws violated the due process law clause. And there was a series of decisions here. Williamson versus Lee Optical of Oklahoma in 1955. This really was the end of the whole thing. This is where it ended in 1937. Well, in 1937, arguably the big case that it ended it was West Coast Hotel versus Parrish in 1937 that signaled the end of the era of Lochner. But in Williamson versus Lee, this is 1955 now, several years later. In that case, the unanimous Supreme Court decision said the day is gone. This is 1955. The day is gone, a year after Brown versus Board of Education. The day is gone when this court uses the due process law clause of the 14th Amendment to strike down state laws regulatory of business and industrial conditions because they may be unwise, improvident, or out of harmony with a particular school of thought. In other words, here's the bottom line. The Constitution says that the federal government can only get involved in what's going on in the states if it involves interstate commerce. This is the basis that Alito used to say that the federal government had no right regulating machine guns. He says, you can't prove this thing had anything to do with interstate commerce. Now, if you extend that logic, and this is a logic, by the way, that the founders felt very strongly about. They wanted the states to be semi-autonomous. But times changed. You know, that concept of autonomy on the part of the states is one of the things that led to the Civil War. The states were so autonomous that they decided, hey, we're going to break off. And so after the Civil War, we went from a weak federal government, strong states, to a weak states, strong federal government, form of government for all practical purposes, and 13, 14, 15 amendments were a part of this. And what these guys are talking about doing, and there was this period from 1905 with the Lochner case up to 1937, when we kind of went back to that era of saying, well, the federal government has no right to interfere with the states. Now, if you extend that logic, if today the court was ruling the same way, it would do away with laws providing for federal unemployment insurance. It would do away with laws providing for federal banking regulation. It would do away with laws providing for many of the Food and Drug Administration. It would do away with laws of workplace protection. It could do away with the Environmental Protection Agency. It could arguably do away with Social Security. I mean, there's a whole spectrum of things that this court could do away with based on this. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
How about a wish for democracy? Welcome back to the pill that will help you escape the matrix. The Tom Hartman radio program. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. As I was saying, that you have to understand the conservative agenda. The conservative agenda is for wealth, inherited wealth and corporate wealth to rule America. The conservatives who believe in this, and they're very sincere in their belief about this. We're talking about the William F. Buckley conservatives, the Bill Kristol conservatives, the George W. Bush conservatives, even the John McCain conservatives. I mean, they put a patina on it of we have to have noblesse oblige. We have the obligation of nobility. We have to rule well. but that there should be a ruling class of the wealthy, you know, and powerful, and it should be basically corporate and inherited wealth ruling America. And they believe this because they believe that this is how you have the most stable country. They look back at the 60s, at the demonstrations in the streets, the early 70s, burning down Watts, burning down Detroit, and they say, that's the result of letting the people have too much power. We can't let the people have too much power. And they really and truly believe that. They believe they're doing the right thing for America. You have to understand that. These conservatives, and they also know that if they simply come out and say to Americans that they believe in essentially an aristocracy, that the Americans won't buy it. That Americans will say, come on, give me a break. We thought this was a nation of, by, and for we the people. No, no, the conservatives say. No, it's a nation of, by, and for multinational corporations, corporate power, and inherited wealth. Because that's more stable. That will be, you know, we'll have a small group, a small elite who are really running the country. They can turn on a dime. If we're threatened, they can handle the threats. It's a whole daddy state thing. We'll take care of you. Don't worry. We'll protect you, not we'll take care of you. The mommy state would take care of you. And because they can't be honest about their belief that democracy is flawed, and if you want the history of this, I mean, go back and read Plato and his conversations about democracy. He didn't believe in democracy either. Neither did Socrates, his mentor. Or for that matter, Aristotle, his student. There's a reason why Socrates had to drink that hemlock. It's because he was involved, in my opinion. I agree with E.F. Stone, who wrote The Trial of Socrates, because he was involved in the revolt, the revolt of the 40 and the revolt of the 400, as I recall, the two revolutions that brought down democracy in Greece, ultimately, you know, began the process. These guys don't believe in democracy. You get the folks from the Ayn Rand, they'll come on here and they'll just say right up front, we don't believe in democracy. At least they're honest about it. The Republicans don't believe in democracy, but they can't say that out loud. So instead they talk about things like the Constitution and states' rights and strict constructionist and activist judge and all. And all of it is coded phrasing for reducing the power of a government of, by, and for we the people, a constitutionally limited republican democracy, a democracy in a republic, of reducing the power of government. And what does that do? It creates a power vacuum into which can step the power of inherited wealth and corporate power. And we've seen this over and over again. And a piece of this is, of course, you know, men's control over women. And here this is just today. Dick Durbin. Yesterday, I played for you early. We started the program 2.5 hours ago. I played for you the clip of Chuck Schumer for 4.5 minutes, taking Alito to task for the fact that he refusing to say whether he still agrees with his 1985 statement that he's proud of the fact that he doesn't believe that there's a right to abortion in the Constitution. And so here's Dick Durbin, just a few minutes ago in the United States Senate. This is just from the last couple of hours.
Yesterday, when you were asked about one man, one vote, you clarified it, said, those are my views then, they're not my views now. When Senator Cole asked you about the power and authority of elected branches as opposed to others, no, you said, I want to clarify, that's not my view now. And yet, when we have tried to press you on this critical statement that you made in that application, a statement which was made by you that said the Constitution does not protect the right to an abortion, you've been unwilling to distance yourself and to say that you disagree with it.
And he's still unwilling to. Because what this is all about is why do you think Justice Sunday was so frenetic about this guy? Get him on the Supreme Court and bang, Roe v. Wade is toast. But it's not just Roe v. Wade. They're going to go back to construing the Constitution the way the court did back in 1905 in the Lochner case. They're going to say, as John Roberts did in the case that involved the toads in California. Remember this? We talked about this during the Roberts confirmation. John Roberts ruled that the environmental protection laws in the United States, the laws that protect the environment and the Environmental Protection Agency, did not have the authority to protect the Endangered Species Act and the EPA enforcing it, did not have the authority to protect an endangered toad species in California from being wiped out by development. And the reason the federal government, John Roberts said, did not have the right or the power to protect that toad species, that protected endangered species, even though the United States Congress had voted that way, even though those folks that we all elected to Congress voted and said, you know, we want to protect endangered species. Even though that was the case, John Roberts, in his ruling, said, no, that toad cannot be protected because he does not engage in interstate commerce. Remember that? And this is the basis upon which Sam Alito has already said, in the case of Bray versus Marriott Hotels in 1997, he dissented. And he said that this was a Marriott hotel manager who said that she had been discriminated against on the basis of race. And Alito, again, he says, the majority explained that Alito would have protected racist employers. This is what they said. The majority of the court, Alito dissented. The majority of the court said that Alito would have protected racist employers by immunizing, I'm quoting from the decision, by immunizing an employer from the reach of Title VII if the employer's belief that it had selected the best candidate was the result of conscious racial bias. The same thing with disability-based discrimination. Hey, you know, it's happening in a local state. In Nathanson versus Nitton Medical College of Pennsylvania, Alito dissented. Strike down the Family and Medical Leave Act, which guarantees workers up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave. I mean, in most of the industrialized world, you get paid leave, right? That was Chester versus Department of Community and Economic Development. So you see what's at stake here. Julie in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Julie, thank you for calling. Thanks for holding so long.
Hi, Tom. I was listening to an African-American radio station locally this morning, and there was an interview with Al Sharpton.
Right.
This is a nationwide show, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And Al Sharpton pointed out that in multiple cases where there had been black employees bringing suit against their white employers, he had never found for the black employees.
He being Alito?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I don't, and you know, I'm not surprised by that. I mean,
but what we're surprised about is that none of the Democrats are bringing this matter up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so what Al Sharpton is saying is, before you vote for a Democrat, check his record. See if he's really going to help you if you're black.
Yeah, and it's not just if you're black, because, Julie, all of us, at some level, in some way, somehow, are minorities or may end up being minorities. I mean, you know, in some way, all of us want to have our rights protected. That's we may become minorities. You know, here I am, a white guy, right, a WASP, a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. I am a minority in some of the beliefs that I hold. And so, you know, we all want to have these protections, whether it's racial minorities or whether it's sexual preference or whether it's simply free speech issues, being on the minority side of an issue. And, Sharpton pointing that out, I'm glad
he
did.
I think also to a degree that when they pass certain bills, for instance, the Americans with Disabilities Act,
right,
that wasn't done so much so that handicapped people could get jobs. It was so that handicapped people living in nursing homes could get jobs and then be made to hand over their paychecks to the nursing home to make up whatever Medicaid wasn't paying.
You really believe that was the case, Julie? You have some evidence of that?
I know of two people who were put in that position.
That's interesting. Well, that's tragic. I didn't, you know, thank you for informing me. Julie, thanks for the call.
Sure.
I appreciate it. That's, something to chew on there. Dave in Eureka, California. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I think we have to reach a bit to find these Bush crew to be motivated ideologically. It's my observation that regular criminal patterns are continuing of deceit, greed, fraud.
Even criminals, Dave, rationalize their criminality by saying that they've got to put food on the table, they've got to do what's best for their family. I mean, you know, Al Capone's dying words were, all I ever tried to do was help people.
Oh, wow. Well, they may try to justify it in such a way, and there may be those who believe ideologically that the masses shouldn't be ruling, but what I see here is severe conduct disorder being demonstrated on us in a bad, bad, harmful way.
Yeah, well, you know, you're the psychologist. I'm just the psychotherapist. I agree with you. I agree with you.
Thank
you. But I would add to that, Dave, that I think that they do have a rationale, and I think that they actually believe their own rationalization, which makes it even scarier. I guess now we're getting into the realm of sociopathy, aren't we?
Psychopathic.
There you go, psychopathy. Thank you very much, Dave. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, it's a marvelous night for a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes. A fantabulous night to make romance beneath the cover of October skies.
Ah, Van Morrison. Welcome back, my friends. 9 minutes before the hour. A radio support group of, by, and for We the People. I'm Tom Hartman here with you. Just, you know, we've done a lot of Alito here today, and I think that there are other things out there that are really important, and I want to share one with you. A new study from the United Kingdom, this absolutely spooky. Actually, this was carried out at the Russian Academy of Sciences. It was published in the independent newspaper in the UK, one of the major national newspapers. Headline, new study shows unborn babies could be harmed by genetically modified foods. Now, keep in mind, the vast majority of the grains that we're eating, or at least I know corn, a good chunk of our corn, is genetically modified. I believe many, if not most, of our other grains are genetically modified. There's a lot of GM food in the food supply of Americans, and none of it is labeled. Because even though over 70% of Americans say they want to know, they want labels on their food that say whether it contains things that are genetically modified or not, the lobbyists for these companies, principally Monsanto, but there are others who are producing these genetically modified organisms and who are then the food manufacturers who are using them, don't want you to know. In Europe, they've refused to accept our exports of genetically modified foods. So here's the story. This just, you know, straight up, Jeffrey Lean reporting in The Independent, the UK, women who eat genetically modified foods while pregnant risk endangering their unborn babies, startling new research suggests. The study, carried out by a leading scientist at the Russian Academy of Sciences, found that more than half of the offspring of rats fed on modified soya diets, died in the first 3 weeks of life. Six times as many as those born to mothers with normal weights. Six times as many were also severely underweight. The research, which is being prepared for publication, is just one of a clutch of recent studies that are reviving fears that genetically modified food damages human health. Italian research, for example, has found that modified soy affects the liver and pancreas of mice. Let me add, by the way, it's very difficult these days to get tofu, unless the tofu or other soy-containing products that aren't genetically modified, unless it says right on the label, does not contain genetically modified soy or does not contain genetically modified corn or potatoes or whatever. You know, the corn chips, the potato chips, the tofu, the, you know, on and on. In all probability, it is. This is why more and more Americans are shopping at the health food store, right? Italian research has found that modified soy affects the liver and pancreas of mice. Australia had to abandon a decade-long attempt to develop genetically modified peas when an official study found that they caused lung damage. And last May, this newspaper, this being the Independent of Great Britain, the United Kingdom, revealed a secret report. Secret report? By the biotech giant Monsanto? A secret report? Well, yes, of course. They're a person, remember? They have the rights of privacy. Which showed that rats fed a diet rich in genetically modified corn had smaller kidneys and higher blood cell counts, suggesting possible damage to their immune systems than those who ate a similar conventional one. So how is the World Trade Organization going to react to this? How's the Bush administration going to react to this? How is our government of, by, and for, we the people going to react to this? By the way, the scientist added flour. Here's how this is how it was conducted. The scientist added flour from a genetically modified soybean produced by Monsanto to be resistant to its pesticide Roundup. This isn't just some, like, you know, Franken soybean. This is the stuff that, you know, you can buy in an American store. This is Roundup Ready soybeans. The scientist added flour from a GM soybean produced by Monsanto to be resistant to its pesticide Roundup to the food of female rats starting 2 weeks before they conceived, continuing through pregnancy, birth, and nursing. Others were given non-genetically modified soy, and a third group was given no soy at all. They found that 36% of the rats fed the modified soy were severely underweight compared with 6% of the offspring of the other groups. There was those who received the non-genetically modified soy and those who received no soy at all. Both had about 6% underweight, severely underweight birth young. 36% of those with the genetically modified soy. More alarmingly, a staggering 55.6% of those born to mothers on the genetically modified diet perished within 3 weeks of birth, compared to 9% of the offspring of those fed normal soya and 6.8% of the young of those given no soya at all. Now, again, did you hear about this in did NPR report this? I don't know. I know that they get a lot of money from the big agribiz companies, so I would doubt it, but maybe they did. Increasingly now it's becoming national Republican radio, but, you know, who knows. I certainly didn't see it on any of the national newscasts. Maybe I missed it. The Monsanto soy they add is widely eaten by Americans. There is little of it or of any genetically modified crop, however, in British foods. So what is Bush going to do about this? Well, now that we know the dangers of this stuff, the World Trade Organization is expected next month to support a bid by the Bush administration to force European countries to accept genetically modified foods. You did not hear me wrong. The World Trade Organization, this is right out of this article, is expected next month to support a bid by the Bush administration to force European countries to accept genetically modified foods. Here we have studies from the Russian Academy of Sciences on rats. You've got studies on, you know, in Italy done on GM corn, smaller kidneys, higher blood counts, damage to the immune system. They had to stop studies on genetically modified peas that were done in Australia because they were causing lung damage to the rats. But no studies done here. Well, actually, there was one. It was a secret report by Monsanto. It was revealed in the United Kingdom, in the UK press, not in ours. And the Bush administration, we're going to push forward with this stuff. It's profitable for our campaign donors, after all, don't you know? Thanks for being with us today, my friends. We'll see you again tomorrow, same time, same place. Carry on.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.